Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to Read Like a Writer, the podcast from Faber and Faber, Serpent's Tale, Profile Books and Canongate. I'm Anna Fielding and today I'm joined in the studio by Claire Adam. Hello, Claire.
Oh, hello, Anna.
Claire's debut novel, Golden Child, will be published on January the 17th, and it's been 5 years in the making, but Golden Child is an absolutely captivating book. It brings the beauty and the problems of Trinidad straight to the reader. We'll talk more about it in a second, Claire, but the story follows one family, the parents who really just want to do the best by their family and their children, and then two very different twins, Paul and Peter. I also thought it was about hard choices, and it really rejects the idea that there's always one correct moral path. So, Claire, this is your first novel, and it's focusing on Trinidad, which is, of course, where you were born and grew up.
Yes, that's right. Yes, so I'm from Trinidad originally. So, so I was born there, and I lived there until I was 18, and then I left and I went to university. And, yeah, so it's a place that I sort of know very well. And, like, when I came to writing, you know, kind of later in life, I sort of tried writing about all different places. Actually, I was writing about, I've been living in England for a long time. So I was trying to write about England. My mother's Irish. So I was writing about Ireland. And I was writing in all these places, about all these places that I'd sort of visited or lived, and nothing was really going very well. And then I was like, oh my God, okay, all right, let's just try and write about Trinidad. And I started writing about Trinidad, and it kind of seemed to work. So, I refused it for a long time, and that's kind of a story in its own right, I suppose. But after a few attempts, I eventually started this book, and it sort of wrote itself.
What was the reason for refusing to somewhere that's obviously very important to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's you know, so I lived in Trinidad all these years, and while I was there, really, me and my siblings, I'm the youngest of four siblings, and really our time there was sort of dominated by trying to get out of Trinidad, which is, you know, kind of similar to what the characters in the book experience. And I think it was just that having worked so hard and spent such a long time trying to get out, you know, I think once you do get out, you kind of feel like you should look to the future, and you kind of don't want to look back. And so, like, to write about Trinidad, I guess, seemed like it was sort of returning to the past. And it's sort of, I just felt like, you know, that's in my past, and I don't want to write about that or think about that, or it's behind me and I just want to do something else. So I think that was why I initially didn't turn to that subject.
That makes sense, actually, because one of the strongest themes in the book is of the family struggles while they're there, and the various issues that their relations have had, and different ones for each sort of section of the family, really. I know that you said in other interviews that the economy of the island is really tied into the oil industry. And so at different points, it will either be a bit of a boom or it will be a bit of a struggle.
Right, exactly. Yes.
And so when the book is set, that's one of the bits where it's starting to become a less wealthy place, isn't it? Those trips to Miami and
whatever,
they're not so much a thing, but they are still within people's memory, and so they're still desirable.
Yeah. I mean, so I said, like, the book is kind of set during the 80s, but it isn't, you know, you sort of try and set it at a time where you know, what you hope is that readers at any time in the future will be able to pick up this book, and without knowing anything about the history of the 80s or the history of oil prices, that the book will still sort of make sense to them. So, like, in my mind, I sort of knew it was the 80s, partly because that's the time that I was living there, so it's a time that I knew well. But I mean, like, it, you know, they're just like these quite small references. I think there's sort of like pop music. There's Tina Turner song and a Smooth Operator song. And there's just a few little references like that. So, yes, I mean, like in reality, like during the 80s, so Trinidad, we have oil and natural gas. And so because like that's sort of the foundation of our economy. And there was a time sort of late 70s, early 80s when the price of oil was very high and the economy was booming. I mean, people had so much money. Like people think of Trinidad and think, oh, maybe it's a poor country. It is not a poor country. It is a rich country because we have all this oil. But then, you know, for all sorts of complicated reasons, there was this world drop in oil prices to do with what Saudi Arabia, I think, flooded the market with oil and blah, blah, blah. And so the price of oil just tumbled. And that was a huge effect on our economy. And we just sank straight into a recession. And so from one day, everybody, as you see, like having these fancy cars and people taking international trips and, you know, having the time of their lives, money was flowing. Suddenly, you know, overnight, everything changed. And so I guess the result of that was that people just started to, you know, jump ship. People started to leave Trinidad in their droves. And so that was kind of the reality of what was happening during the 80s. And that, you know, a lot of my, like I, you know, friends from school, you know, many of my friends, they just left Trinidad, you know, and like in many cases, it was quite difficult for the families to leave. They were sort of headed, you know, they might have been headed to England or to the US or to Canada. And I mean, I think North America was certainly a destination, you know, because there was sort of the idea at the time that you could go and you could kind of work your way up and stuff like that. And so people would go and like families would kind of separate, like the mom would go ahead first and, the, you know, the dad and the kids would stay behind, or mom and dad would both go and kids was, and like, you know, you'd have these kids who were like 12, 13, who'd be like keeping house and getting all the children to school. And like, you know, this is kind of the level of sacrifice that people made to try and get out of Trinidad and get to somewhere better. But I mean, so that was sort of, that was the reality of what was happening in Trinidad, you know, at that time. But like what's in the book, it's, you know, as I say, they're just like hints of the actual, you know, that it is the 80s, is the pop songs and stuff like that. But, you know, I'm not sort of, you know, I've taken quite a lot of artistic license in other places. So there are various things that happen in the book that did not happen during the 80s. But I mean, the backdrop to the whole thing is that, you know, you know, it's a country that, you know, has many wonderful things about it. Of course, the weather, some people think the weather is great. You have beaches, you know, you could pick fruit off the trees. I mean, there's lots of wonderful things about this place. You know, it's a very social place, a lot of parties. People don't get sort of isolated the way that they do in cities. But on the other hand, it was a place that, you know, that people sometimes want to escape from. And in this particular family, I think they have, you know, they have one very bright child and they really want the best for this child. And they're willing to, you know, I guess the book asks, like, how much of a sacrifice should a family make or should a parent make, you know, to try and get the best for the child who is capable of more than what that particular country can offer.
It is, it presents things in really interesting ways, actually, because you may think that there's kind of a cut and dried moral answer to a lot of things. But I think what Golden Child does so well is it brings in those shades of ambiguity. And, you know, there are some quite shocking things that happen, but you're never quite sure if they're for the best or not for the best, really. And I think that's something that you keep thinking about long after you've read the book. I'm finding it very hard, actually, to sort of talk to you about this without doing terrible spoilers.
Well,
for anyone
I know. I find it really hard too. Yes, I find it hard too, because like for me, of course, like as the author, like I know the whole book. And of course, like when I was writing it, I actually did know, you know, some of the key things that happen in the book. I sort of knew them from the outset. And so it is quite hard to kind of talk about it without talking about sort of the big picture that I always could see myself, because it sort of gives away too much. I mean, I do hope that it's not cut and dried. I mean, you know, like it's some advanced copies have sort of gone out and, you know, there's reviews on Goodreads, you know, and I mean, people tell you shouldn't do this to me, but I have been reading all my Goodreads reviews. Partly because it's very, like, I'm not, you know, I am happy to say that it's generally getting good reviews. It's 4-star. I can't remember. You know, generally it's going well. But you know, I'm very sort of interested in the people who give it 1 or 2 stars. I'm like, okay, why did this book not work for you? What did you, you know, what did I sort of try and what did I set out to do that failed for you? And I think that, well, I mean, there are many things, but I think that maybe this is probably not exactly what you were asking, Anna. So I'm sort of, you know,
I'm still interested
going off on a tangent here, but yeah, I suppose people have different preconceptions about what a place like Trinidad might be like, or people have, I suppose they might have their moral preconceptions about what is right and wrong, I suppose those as well. So yes, I mean, I suppose the book, you know, it would be, if people felt that those things were challenged in their minds, I would feel that's a success.
Yes, I certainly sort of went through several different flips about what I thought would be the right course of action throughout it. But we're going to leave Trinidad and go to somewhere much closer to your current home, and talk about your favourite independent bookshop, which is a question we ask everybody on this podcast.
Yes.
So you're going to tell us about Kirkdale Books.
Yes, yes. So I will tell you about Kirkdale Books. And so so this is in Sydenham, which is in southeast London. And it's, oh, what can I say about Kirkdale? It's a lovely, it's just a lovely little bookshop. It's, I mean, it seems very small from the outside. It's got like the, you know, the fruit and veg shop on one side, and it's got, I think we've got an estate agent now on the other side, and there's Kirkdale Bookshop. It's like this little sort of narrow little, little shop in the middle. And, but you go in and actually they manage to fit so much inside that bookshop. So, you know, all the sort of the new hot books, often in hardback, are kind of right there at the front as soon as you go in. And they're extremely tempting, honestly. I walk in and I know I should not be buying these books, and my hand kind of reaches out. And like, you know, Michelle Obama's book is there now and that sort of thing. And in the back there is a children's section, and it's got a nice sort of colourful carpet and comfy seating. And then behind that, there's the owner's office, Geraldine's office. And I was in there the other day, actually, because I was talking to her about something. And it's really like something out of Dickens. I hope Geraldine doesn't mind me saying all this, that it's these sort of towering piles of paper. And it's lovely, I have to say. And then so on the side, there's like this a little room where you can get your tea and coffee, and you have the place to sit down, and you can take your book and you can just sit there on the chair and have your coffee and nobody will disturb you. And I mean, it really is a huge luxury, I think, in, you know, in this day and age, to you know, to be able to sort of walk into a shop and pick something off the shelf and sit and look at it, and nobody will bother you and nobody will hassle you and say, how long you've been reading that book, and get out of here. So I mean, that is, you know, that really is a wonderful thing about bookshops in general, and certainly a wonderful thing about Kirkdale. And I mean, and they do all sorts of things, of course. You know, they do readings for kids on a Saturday morning, and they run, you know, readings, and they run a book club, and there's sort of a gallery room on the side, and it's got sort of a skylight with natural light, and that's where you get your tea and coffee. And then there's even more downstairs. Downstairs they have all the sort of, you know, that really is just like, I hope Geraldine doesn't mind me saying, it's like the sort of cobwebby kind of, you go down these creaking steps, and there are all these sort of, you know, these really old sort of, you know, they fall apart in your fingers types of books. And some of them are very expensive because they're actually antique books, and other ones are just, you know, sort of secondhand. But there's, it's a treasure trove in there. And yeah, so it is the kind of, I mean, I don't know if I just see it this way because I like books myself and I like bookshops, but to me it sort of seems like a little kind of little hub of the community, really. Like, yes, all sorts of little sort of community actions have, you know, that's kind of been their centre. Like we had or we still have actually, a Sydenham Arts Festival, which runs in the summer. And like all the, you know, they were the box office for that. They would sell all the tickets and you'd go in and, you know, get all the information about these events. And we have, there's somebody who used to work at the bookshop, Jonathan Kaufman, who, he has a theatre company. And again, you know, that Kirkdale Bookshop was sort of the place where you would go to get your tickets and find out all the schedules. And now, in fact, that theatre company has blossomed, and there's kind of a theatre space which is provided by Lewisham Council. It's all a bit complicated and I may be getting it wrong, but you know, that's, you know, there was this, you know, this sort of arts festival and the theatre and all that has sort of grown out of, you know, just having that bookshop, which was this sort of solid place to go. And it was always there. You know, other shops sometimes came and went, but that bookshop was still there.
So talking about the books that you'd buy from there that you'd like to tell our readers about as well. And I've got to say, it sounds like a fantastic place. I have friends down that way, so I shall definitely
next
time I visit
them. Oh, it's very good. Yeah.
But one of the books you wanted to talk to us about is Doris Lessing's The Grass is Singing.
Yes.
And I know that this is a book that you said probably had quite an impact on your current novel as well. Could you tell me a bit about why that is?
Yes. So I only read Doris Lessing when I came here to London. But previously, like when I'd been living in Trinidad, it wasn't that easy to get books actually in Trinidad. And so we often, like, you know, because my mother's Irish, used to come to Ireland every 3 years and then kind of fill up our suitcases and take them home again, you know. But it was interesting, just a few books, and these are the, well, you know, there's Alan Paton and Chinua Achebe, you know, those sorts of books. Like it was really interesting just reading those. And I was sort of trying to think about why it was. And I think it's to do with, it's just the physical reality of their landscape is similar to ours. So like, I think it's in Cry the Beloved Country that, you know, it talks about the red brown dirt, and the, that the soil is so dry, and I remember reading that and thinking, well, that's exactly how ours is, because, you know, of course we have read many books about places like England, and England is typically described as, you know, very green sort of fields, and you have oak trees, and I mean, and those things
very
are
damp.
Very damp and all those things, and that's all wonderful, but, you know, so coming like from a tropical sort of setting, those things were quite foreign for us. And so it was really interesting reading the, you know, these few books that I read that had been set in Africa. Of course, Africa is a huge continent and it's, you know, it's a huge variation, but just the one or two that I did read, I think they made an impression because the landscape was something about the landscape and the temperatures and other sort of physical facts were similar to what we experienced. So that's a very long way of getting around to why I was interested in Doris Lessing at all. And
I was just going to say, for the benefit of people listening who may not know, that The Grass is Singing is set in southern Rhodesia in the 1940s, as the country was called then. It's now Zimbabwe, that
right.
part of the land.
Right.
But sorry, anyway.
Yes, no, that's okay.
And I think it probably relates to what you were going to say
as well. Yeah, and I think that, the book is sort of about... I mean, people may be familiar with it already, but it starts with like a little press clipping, and it's a murder. So there's a white couple, it's Mary and Richard Turner, the white couple, and they have this farm. And Mary Turner has been murdered, it seems apparent, by her houseboy, who's a black houseboy. And it starts off as murder mystery. So it's this little sort of cutting in the news, this little article in the newspaper that announces the murder. And then the first section is just about the reaction of the townspeople, and the townspeople are very sort of, they don't talk about it, and there's this sort of knowingness. They seem to know something that went on, and they all they say about it is that it's a bad business. It was a bad business, and so it's the ending sort of given away because you already know who was murdered and that sort of thing. But then the rest of the book is sort of trying to go back to the beginning of, you know, Mary's sort of teenagerhood and how she got married and how she came to be on that farm and how she got to know this particular houseboy, as he's called, is called Moses, and then leading up to the murder. And what is interesting to me about this book is the sense of omniscience. So omniscience has kind of gone out of fashion, I think, in writing terms. And, you know, like nowadays, we're, you know, if you do writing courses, you're sort of told, oh, you know, stay in one person's head at a time. And if you kind of, you know, you can't jump from one person's head to the other person's head, and like to sort of create a world where the author knows everything, that is very out of fashion now. There was a time when that was the done thing, and now it's like totally not the done thing. And if you go to writing classes and try to do that, people are like, oh my God, this is terrible, because we do not want to, and people just don't want omniscience anymore. And so I think what was interesting about this book to me was that she completely does this, you know, and she does it extremely successfully. And so, you know, we go into everybody's head, and we go, and sometimes we zoom right in into like these teeny tiny details. Like one thing that stuck with me was, you know, the poor Mary, when she was married, she's on the veranda, and like, I mean, this is a very harsh landscape. You know, they had this little house, which I can't remember, they may have built it themselves, and this little tin roof. Again, which is something which is very familiar, like coming from Trinidad. Like, I know what a house like that looks like. I know what it is like to live inside a house with that heat. And she was, you know, she's lying after having been killed, sadly, you know, she's lying on the veranda, and there was something about like the cracked, yellowed soles of her feet. And like, you know, so I think what made an impression on me was just this sort of zooming into these tiny details and then just like pulling straight, you know, pulling back out so that she has this huge bird's eye view of like the entire universe that she's writing about. And she manages to do all these things, and the whole thing works, and she pulls it on. This is her first book.
I'm kind of fascinated. Why do you think omniscience has gone out of fashion?
Well, I don't know. That's a really good question. I don't know. I mean, I think it's that, I don't know. I would like to say I did physics as my degree. So there are all these sort of literature things that, other people sort of talk about. So I'm like, oh my God, I have no idea why this is. And so I feel like I have a lot to catch up on. But
however, as a physicist, you should be really good about thinking about multiple universes all at once.
Exactly. So, and I do.
You're used to stretching your brain in that way.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Talking about the novel that you always recommend to people, it's a personal favourite of mine as well. You've picked Raymond Carver's short stories, What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. Now, what is it that makes you always recommend Carver?
Yes, well, Carver, I mean, again, Carver was somebody who I didn't know about before. So I did an MA at Goldsmiths 5 years ago or something like that. And, when I went to the MA, everyone's like, there's this kind of list of authors that everybody seems to know and everybody seems to talk about. And I'd never heard of this author. And I read this author. And to be honest with you, I mean, so Raymond Carver, so he's American and... I should have all these facts at my fingertips, so I don't remember. But, he's sort of working class Americans. He writes about... working class Americans, they all drink too much and they smoke and they have arguments and, they're very, I guess they're sort of known for being like normal people. And he writes these very short stories and, well, not necessarily very short, but he writes short stories and they're sort of known for being very, very pared back. And he famously had this editor, Gordon Lish, who sort of like, gutted these stories and like, cut out half of them, and that's a whole other controversy in itself.
I've seen bits where they're so precise they can say, yes, this one was 9% shorter. It's like, who quantifies it to that level? Gordon Lish did, clearly.
Oh my God, I know. But yes, but the reason I recommend them to people is for a number of reasons. I mean, one, because they're short. So I recommend them to people who don't read a lot, to be honest. And if I talk to people who say, I don't read and I don't really have time to read and, oh God, I could never... I really find my way into a book. I say, but just try these. Look, here's these short stories, and they're very short, actually. And the other thing is, of course, Raymond Carver is a man, and many of his characters, there's both male and female characters, but there's a lot of men in there. And I kind of think, if they're men who maybe don't like to read or, don't like to read fiction, sometimes men, I hate to generalize, but, and I feel like men maybe could benefit from reading these stories.
I think before it was even a popular phrase, he's always been quite good at portraying what we now call toxic masculinity.
Right, exactly. You see, I mean, I do go online, don't get me wrong. Like I am, but I have like a little Nokia phone and I'm sort of trying to stay away from sort of technology and these kinds of things. So I know that all of, many, many things are all sort of explained online and I could find all the good words. But yes, I do it the slow way. I kind of try and figure things out for myself. But yes, you're right. Toxic masculinity. Yes, that probably is why I think, maybe some men could sort of benefit from reading these stories. But I think as well, like the other thing about the stories is that, you know, there's so much which is maybe because of Gordon Lish or maybe because of how Carver wrote them. I mean, they're very what's the word? They just talk about, there isn't that much of the sort of interior monologue. It's just it takes a very external viewpoint. You know, somebody does this and somebody does that. Somebody opens the door. Somebody has a cup of coffee. So you just get the actions. You just get the sort of physical dramatic action most of the time. You get a little bit of internal thought, but I mean, the consequence of that is that the reader has to figure a lot out for themselves. And many times you might read one of Raymond Carver's stories and not really know what it's about. But despite that, you might still find sometime later that story is still in your mind and you're still sort of trying to puzzle something out, which is, of course, a mark of, many people would say is the mark, you know, whether it is or not, I don't know. But many people would say that it is the mark of a very good story. But I think, you know, so I think I'm still in that state for many Raymond Carver stories. I still sort of feel, you know, I still don't know what that story was about. But I think there's like, you know, like in maths, you know, there's a thing about maths, you know, sometimes you can't figure out a problem and you might think, oh my God, I'm so dumb, I can't figure out this problem. But actually there's a thing which is like, to be stuck on a problem is an honorable state. So, you know, while you're there, while your mind is grappling with the problem, that is actually an honorable state to be in. It's a state of dignity to be, you know, toughing, you know, to be staying with this problem. So I sort of think that's a little bit about the Raymond Carver stories. I think, you know, even if they don't make sense straight away, you know, I think there's value in just sitting with it and wait and see what comes out.
Mm. I really like that, actually, the state of grace of grappling with something. I think that's probably something we could all bear in mind. Mm. If you ever come to write a self-help book, that's your title, I think. So talking about things that are sitting with you, this is a book that's sat with a lot of people for a very long time. Your classic that you've chosen is, I think, probably what would be many people's classic pick as well. Yes. It's Pride and Prejudice.
Yes, yes.
Why? What's your take on Pride and Prejudice? Because everyone has their own one.
Right, okay. I mean, I thought this one was interesting to mention just because... because, you know, again, I read this when I was in Trinidad. And I mean, as everybody knows, this is a story set in, you know, in England of times past. And, you know, there are these sort of very what now seem like sort of archaic concepts of having, you know, 4,000 a year or 5,000 a year. And I just thought I thought people might like to hear that, you know, that for me growing up in Trinidad, that I also was able to enjoy this book, even though I didn't sort of know what many of the things meant. Like I couldn't visualize a place like Netherfield Hall or and it did seem sort of quite weird that, you know, that people seemed so preoccupied with how much money people had and things like that. But the basics of the story, the sort of, you know, here's, you know, this mother who wants to marry off her girls, and we're like, oh yes, I know exactly what that is like.
She's a universal figure, Mrs. Absolutely. Bennet, isn't she?
And you know, then you have the Lady Catherine de Bourgh who's sort of trying to tell Lizzie what to do, and you're like, no way, Lizzie, you stand up to her. And like, you know, so we sort of, even though we didn't sort of know what's kind of lady this and sir that, we didn't sort of have any context for that. I mean, of course, you know, just from reading about it in other books, but like, we didn't have that in our society at all. But we still had the concept of, like, you know, the big person and the little person, and the little person's kind of standing up to, you know, and saying, I'm not going to take any of that. And then, of course, it's so romantic and Mr. Darcy. I mean, so it was...
But of course.
Yeah, but of course, exactly. Which I know is just so, like, that's commonplace for you guys. But I think that, for me, it's quite remarkable that, you know, as a kid in Trinidad, you know, I live in a tropical country, I'm talking about, you know, we have none of this kind of servants and big houses. We have none of that. And yet the story... sort of was enjoyable by me also.
So another one set in a tropical part of a country. It's actually the one you've chosen for your favourite cover, which is Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things. And it is the classic, I was asking you about this earlier, and yes, it is the classic cover.
Yes. I just love this. I have to say, I just love this cover. I think, so the cover, if you haven't seen it, it's sort of, so the book is set in India and it's about these twins, and it's a beautiful story about sort of forbidden love, I suppose, with the twins, Esther and Rahel, and their mother, Amu, and then the person who their mother loves, who's an untouchable and is not supposed to love, and everything sort of goes horribly wrong, but there's so much love and beauty in the story. It's just absolutely gorgeous. And so the cover of the book is, it's sort of, the colours are kind of a, you know, sort of a swampy grey, maybe sort of a greyish green. But I mean, it's there lotus leaves on a pond. And then there's just this one very tiny, beautiful pink flower. And the flower is so bright. It's very tiny, but it's so bright and beautiful that it's sort of, you know, it sort of casts this glow over the rest of the picture. And it's as though this little bright thing, which is sort of trying so hard to grow against, you know, perhaps the ugliness and the sort of despair of the rest of the story, say. So it's this, it's very beautiful, I think.
And Carol is such a lush and verdant place, and to sort of pair that back to make the point about the story, it's actually a really nice piece of graphic design.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yes. I mean, and I think it's just a beautiful cover.
I was going to ask you on this book, actually, because I was thinking about the sort of twins motif, and obviously you've twins in your book as well.
Yes.
Do you think twins in literature have a particular resonance, or twins in general life at all?
That's a good question. I don't know. I mean, like, I guess I chose twins for this story because it's a bit tricky to talk about it without giving away the ending, but I suppose I wanted to make these two boys the same, aside from one being very bright and one being not so much. Like, I felt if I made them a boy and a girl, you know, because the family is sort of Indo-Trinidadian, I felt that people would sort of make assumptions about what the value of the girl is versus what the value of the boy was. And I felt if one was older or younger, then, you know, that sort of would cause people to sort of make assumptions as well. I just thought that if they were twins, it sort of put them on level pegging. It meant that they were sort of on equal footing, and you know, the parents have to try and be fair to both. I mean, as parents would be anyway, but it sort of was an extra reason to sort of be fair to both boys.
There's no external societal pressure or any kind of prejudices apart from the actual children themselves.
Exactly. Good. You put it so much better than I can.
Hey, you wrote the whole book. You're okay. You've already done a lot of thinking about this. And then there's a book that you think that people will be really surprised that you enjoy, which is South, isn't it?
Yes. So this is, I mean, I don't normally read nonfiction. So this is South by Shackleton. So this is Ernest Shackleton, the polar explorer. And yes, I don't normally read nonfiction at all. I find it very sort of da 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 da. But you know, sometimes a book, you know, it sort of finds you at the right time. And I think I was traveling, my husband is from New Zealand, and so we were traveling to New Zealand, and I picked this up. I think I picked it up in the airport. And you know, I opened this book in the airport, and I'm just going to read the first sentence of it. So I said, after the conquest of the South Pole by Amundsen, who, by a narrow margin of days only, was in advance of the British expedition under Scott, there remained but one great object of Antarctic journeyings, the crossing of the South Polar continent from sea to sea. So that's a bit of a long sentence, but it's, you know, it's like, you know, here's this man, he's right, he's like, you know, well, somebody else, you know, reached the pole, there's only one other thing left to do, and that's cross the continent. And I mean, it was just such a fantastic adventure story. And I mean, many people already know sort of some of what happened, but so they didn't make it very far. So they were on this boat, which was the Endurance, and they were, you know, they set off from New Zealand, and it was December 5th, I think it was 1914, and they set off. But I mean, I think they were trying to travel it in what would have been the Antarctic summer, and they were hoping for good conditions, but there was just ice. The ice is everywhere, and so the boat. I mean, this boat is, you know, fantastically made, and it was sort of, you know, pushing through this ice, but the boat eventually got trapped in the ice, and they had to abandon it. And then they were just trying to get themselves to safety. And I mean, you know, the amount of peril is just fun. You know, the pieces of ice are sort of like breaking up onto their feet, and like it's freezing cold, and there are these blizzards, and then they're like, to top it all off, they're like killer whales who are like jumping out of the water trying to get them. And I mean, it's just an amazing adventure story. And I think Shackleton nowadays is sort of studied in these leadership courses, because he, you know, so they had split up into a couple of different groups, in the other group, I think another sort of set of people were supposed to be laying depots and for the journey. And some of those men unfortunately died on their way. But of Shackleton's team, you know, even though he lost the boat and he had to, you know, the amount of stuff that he had to do was amazing, but he brought every man back alive. So quite a story.
was quite a story, and bringing everyone back alive at that particular time as well, because I think he set sail just days after the First World War started as well, didn't he?
Yes, exactly. And I think that he says this in the book, that they had to do a lot of fundraising and a lot of preparation and get the boat ready and all, there was all this stuff that they had to do. And then just as they were about to set off, there was the declaration of war. And of course, all the men, they all sort of said, look, we'll just abandon everything right now and we'll go and fight. We're absolutely ready to do that. But George V, I think, he just sent them a telegram saying, proceed. And so off they went. But they were, I think the whole time they were a little bit unsure about whether obviously they had their instruction. The instruction said, go ahead, do it. This is for British adventure. And you're doing, they were doing sort of observations and experiments and things like that as well. But they were just dying to know what was happening with the war and they wanted to be there. They didn't. And I think that they did. They did experience a bit of a mixed reception when they came back, because, maybe some people sort of said, you were hiding out in the Antarctic when everybody else was here fighting for our country. But there was that.
Mm-hmm. You'd hope it would be a bit of a morale boost. But now, this is one I don't know at all, but it's a book you're really looking forward to reading as well, which is Lisa Halliday's Asymmetry. So tell me about it so I can look forward to it too.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that much about it, except that it's the big book over there. I mean, it's out here as well. So it's, I really should have got my hands on it by now. So this is Asymmetry by Lisa Halliday. And the sorts of reviews that it's getting are just like, this is the most incredible book. And it's this sort of genre busting, earth shattering kind of thing. So, that's pretty much all I know about it, actually. But it's, it keeps on kind of coming up in on all the usual places, on Twitter and social media. So it's like, wow, this amazing book. And I know that there's, possibly one of the talking points about it was that I think the author, maybe had a relationship with Philip Roth or something along those lines. And there's this sort of whole, Me Too and maybe inappropriate. I don't even know. I'm just guessing. I'm just sort of thinking, there's just the little that I've sort of heard about it. But yes, that's definitely one book that I would love to get my hands on. And, because from my point of view, of course, I've written my first book. I'm trying to write more. I'm trying to write stories. I'm trying to write another book. For me, it's really interesting to sort of see what other writers are doing. And especially if people are talking about something as if it's like she's done something amazingly new, then I want to know what that is.
I think we all do. Mm-hmm. Claire, thank you so much for coming in today. It's been really interesting talking to you, and I just wish we had longer to kind of go into things more, Claire Adams' Golden Child is out on January the 17th with Faber and Faber. Read Like a Writer was brought to you by Faber and Faber, Serpent's Tale and Canongate, and was presented by me, Anna Fielding. To get a full list of what this week's author recommended, visit acast.com/readlikeawriter. And we'd love to hear what you have to say too, so do tweet us at readlikeapod.